Let me ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a little sexy surprise for you. Second, a specially selected toy for your friend. And third, a little something we know everybody will enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length DVDs. Adult style, you know what I'm saying. Number 10, the 10th gift, is free shipping on your entire order. Gotta love that. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Yet. Just go to AdamandEve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, sexy piece of lingerie, or anything you desire. Just enter offer code SEXNERD at checkout, and you'll get the 10 free gifts. Go check out AdamandEve.com today, select one item, and you'll get 10 things, including free shipping. When you enter offer code SEXNERD, that's SEXNERD, at AdamandEve.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey, sex nerds. Hi, welcome to the show. Sandra Doherty here. That's right. I'm glad to see you again. Hey, sitting next to me, FYI, I don't know if you listened to some of our most popular episodes here at Sex Nerd Sandra podcast, but Allison Moon. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Sandra.
Author of Hungry Ghost, Tales of the Pack, Girl Sex 101, which is coming out soon. When's it happening?
Girl Sex 101 will release in February.
Okay. Because right now it's the fall. So
keep your legs crossed a couple more months.
I can't. I'm teaching Snatch Attack next week. I gotta talk about attacking of the snatch.
I have a feeling you know how to attack snatch.
I know some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
I know.
You know.
Wait, who knows? Never mind.
Speaking of dates, Los Angeles, hi. I am in town teaching Snatch Attack next week, September 22nd at the Los Angeles Academy of Sex Ed. Fun. And then Austin, hey Austin, September 27th, it's a Saturday. I will be in Austin at Forbidden Fruit. Forbidden Fruit, it turns out, is the naughtiest business in Austin. It's been voted that 17 years in a row. It's pretty cool. I will be there on that Saturday talking to people about any of their secret questions. It will be a Q&A. Check out my website for more deets. Hi, Allison. Hi. Give me the eyes, your radio voice. stop eyeing me with your radio voice. So anyway, all those links are at sexnerdsandra.com. Allison, back to you. Tell me more. I am teaching a class on Snatch Attack, but you are publishing a book on girl sexing. So is there something that you really hope I cover? Like, oh, you just gave me a look.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was a double entendre.
Oh.
Uncover something that you uncover. So I think what's really important is this is about just about cunnilingus.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of like basic anatomy, like, hey y'alls, remember clitoral legs up and over there, stuff like that for sure. But I mean, yeah, it's going to be oral. I mean, but there'll be a lot of hand sex stuff going on since that's so much of it too.
Okay, yeah, totally. Well, I think, and I've said this before, so if you haven't heard me say it before, go to Snatch Attack episode. But I think one of the things that people really undervalue when you're playing with snatch, since we're using the vernacular.
Hey, vulva, vagina.
Vulva, vagina.
Sometimes I say it like that accidentally.
It's kind of cute. Reminds me of my roots. pressure. Pressure is important because with pressure you can put, you can stimulate those lovely clitoral legs that are on the inside beneath a lot of flesh by putting pressure on mounds and things. And I think that's really important. A lot of people tend to touch vulvas a little bit too lightly, which can either read as annoying to people who are very sensitive or can just not register pleasure in the way that a lot of people like pleasure, to feel pleasure on their groinal regions. So I think pressure is a big one to think about. And that also, when you do that with cunnilingus, often translates to finding a mouth position that works and keeping your mouth there and applying pressure with your mouth while your tongue is going to town.
Yeah. It's like, I think of it as like fencing off the perimeter. No?
No, I mean, yeah, it is kind of like it's an electric fence of lip. And inside is where all the magic is happening.
Yeah, It's the closest thing I can think of. It's like you gotta keep that clit under wraps.
Yeah, yeah. You gotta hold everything in place because you know it gets a lot. There's a lot of movement down there, which can be lovely. Mm-hmm. But all those things moving in different directions can sometimes get in the way, especially when you found the move mm-hmm. that your partner really digs. You want that move to maintain. You don't want that move to be distracted by a lot of other flapping that's happening.
Like when people do embroidery and they have the circle like that holds the fabric taut. You have to do that in order to do what you need to do with the cloth in the middle.
That is a fantastic analogy. That is absolutely when you said that I'm like, yes, holding things taut so that although needles now are going in a place in my imagination that is unsafe. But yeah, absolutely. The holding of the tautness is very important, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I love analogies. So good.
They're very useful for educational purposes.
I actually have some guilt because I taught an anal 101 class in DC recently, and I tweeted, like, all the metaphors! And then I got there, and, like, for some reason, no metaphors were coming out of me. Like it just wasn't, for some reason, like, I always, you reference all these wacky things in life and how they relate, and yet...
No blossoming rosebuds or...
Yeah, nothing... I think I just set the bar. There was too much pressure. Like the expectation for metaphors, and then suddenly it was, it's like I'm only make people laugh when there's no pressure to make people laugh. The minute there's pressure, then like suddenly, I'm the least funny person that ever walked the earth.
I think that's probably a fairly common thing. I remember the first time I taught Girl Sex 101, which is now called How to Drive a Vulva, And I bombed. I usually teach that class great, but it was for a bunch of straight men, and that was not usually my demographic. Mm-hmm. And so I had a room full of straight men who did not bring their wives or girlfriends to the class, which is so unlike my San Francisco crowd.
Oh, yeah, that's so rare.
Yeah, so that was a very bizarre class, and it totally threw me off my game. And I'm usually very funny, but I was scared of being too funny or irreverent for a bunch of ended up being a bunch of very nervous men mm-hmm. who made me even nervouser because we were like in this feedback loop of anxiety.
Dude, you see, okay. So recently I taught a private workshop for a group of men that were all friends. This group, like I couldn't really figure them out. Like I couldn't get, like I couldn't connect well with them. Like I couldn't, and usually it's like there's like, this is uncomfortable. But it turned out that they were all really good at it or that they'd all studied. Or like at least half the friends had studied sex a lot and like were in like these tantra communities, and I just didn't get that read off them at all. So if they had told me, I could have gone so much deeper and more like complex, but I was only going on the fact that I was paid entertainment for like a bro bonding weekend that wanted some, I don't know. I just have guilt because I don't know. Lots of guilt around past classes coming up for me. Hi, Allison.
Hi. This is what happens when sex educators get together.
Yeah, we just
moan about the past failings where we've left people behind.
Right.
That one person we couldn't reach.
Right. What is it in us that wants to do that?
We have grand empathy for people.
Oh, how annoying.
We want to see people succeed.
I'm admiring narcissists more and more, just the fact that they don't, because like you care so much
about yourself. Wait, narcissists?
No. I mean like being so like wanting to be that thing that connects people and heals. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, it'd be so great to just be a big old D-bag, you know?
Oh, wait, not caring about people would be really fun to not care about.
Yeah.
People. Oh, yeah, that'd be awesome.
It'd just be like...
That'd be so easy.
Yeah, like, hey guys, pay attention to me because I'm awesome.
Yeah, let's do that instead. Screw you guys. We're just going to be awesome on our own.
Right.
That would be kind of weird for your podcast, I think, though.
Yeah, that'd be like... Then I'd just be a comedy podcast because... Not all of them. Just some of them. No, naming no names.
Hashtag not all podcasts.
Okay, this is going in such a weird direction. Okay, what else? Thank you to everyone who commented on iTunes and Yelp and people who are going to merchtable.com to get Sex Nerd Sandra merch. And actually, Allison was just inspiring me to how to figure out how to make Go Team Fun t-shirts in a way that would really light me up. Yay! Oh, Allison, where can people find you?
Girlsex101.com.
Well, that's pretty memorable. Good job.
Thanks.
Can they pre-order? They can pre-order.
Yeah, they can pre-order the book now. And I also have a new book coming out in November called Bad Dyke, which is going to be a collection of true sexy stories from my sex life.
So is the fox can... is the fox hunt in there?
Oh, the fox hunt features prominently.
Oh, awesome. Okay, cool. Okay. All right. Bye, you guys. Go team fun.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
So my primary media experience up until like beginning to be connected with Simon & Schuster has been being interviewed by my students about alcohol prevention.
Aww.
Yeah.
And that was your primary microphone
That's
experience.
How I know how to, like, all my experience with using microphones and checking levels comes from talking to the students about what happens if they're transported to the hospital because of alcohol and they are mandated to see me. What happens in that meeting and how I'm not scary and it doesn't suck.
Huh. Aww. I like that we set the legal limit for alcohol really high. Or limit the age for alcohol. I shouldn't have drank before I did this.
You didn't have much. You had almost nothing.
It affects me quickly.
Oh, are you sensitive?
Yes. Mm. It affects me quickly. But kind of like where I don't believe it is, mm-hmm. but it is.
Yeah.
But just a little bit.
So the main thing that I teach, because alcohol education is a really big part of what I do, mm-hmm. I teach the pleasure plateau.
Oh.
Right? The 0.06 blood. Alcohol has a biphasic effect, as almost everyone who's consumed too much alcohol is mm-hmm. aware, where you drink a little bit and things get better, and the myth is that if you drink more, things continue to get better. Turns out, no. At a certain point, you start losing the good stuff, the disinhibition and the relaxation and the mm-hmm. social, and you start getting to the seriously bad nonsense. I was calling this the zone of regret or the valley of regret, but my students are like, no, we don't like that word. Now they call it the mad strugs.
The mad strugs. Is that a reference to something?
Apparently one of the sports teams uses it as a term for when they're suffering and not doing well. It's like mad struggle.
Right? Oh, got the mad strugs. I just learned about get buck. Do you know about that? Like, just instead of getting buck wild, let's get buck.
I know buck from... So you think you can dance?
No, this is just getting buck wild, but just shorter.
Okay.
Like mad strugs.
I don't even actually know what buck wild is. Like, sexually buck wild?
Oh, like... Yeah, like riding a horse and like rodeo, like getting buck wild, taking off your shirt. I don't know, it's buck wild.
Okay.
Oh,
little lady, get buck wild anymore.
I don't think you are any older than me. You look younger than me.
I'm 37.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an old lady.
No, you're not an old lady, but you are older than me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We're probably in, you are a full adult, like a developmentally sound adult human. Yeah.
By the time I thought getting the third degree was going to be, but the PhD was going to be the point at which I became an adult. No, that had nothing to do with being an adult. I became an adult when I bought a house.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And actually on that topic, what do you do in the world? Emily Nagoski.
Nagoski.
Oh, I knew because I was like, I should pull out the notes that I made. Nagoski.
Nagoski.
Emily Nagoski. Hey, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello.
I may include some of that previous discussion, just
feel
so
free.
You know. What's up? You were so delightful in a session we were at. We were at Woodhull Freedom. I always leave out the sexual part of it. Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit. So you were delightful yesterday. And I was like, I need to get you on the show. What do you do out in the world? And what is this PhD about?
My job title is Director of Wellness Education at Smith College.
Mm-hmm.
My academic background is basically in public health. My PhD is in health behavior with a doctoral minor in human sexuality. My master's degree is in counseling, and I concentrated in sex therapy. Mm-hmm. And my undergrad degree is in psychology with minors in cognitive science and philosophy, which has come in very handy in my life. And I actually started...
Really? Are you joking right now?
Actually, the brain science and the philosophy in particular have come in really handy.
Fantastic. Okay, good.
Yeah. Because I'm the kind of like science-y person who, you know, starts talking about rat research when other people are talking about the Panopticon and Foucault.
Of course.
Right.
Spread it out.
Yeah. So I got trained as a peer educator originally in my very first semester in undergrad. I knew I was going to be going to grad school for something. I had no idea what. And so I needed volunteer work on my resume, right? And there was a pre-med guy on my floor who was like, hey, come be a peer health educator with me. So I applied for it and I got interviewed and I got accepted and I got trained. And it turned out in the process of that training, I, unlike other people, felt really comfortable talking about sex right from the very beginning. Oh. I just didn't have that thing that a lot of people do. And sitting in front of a group of students or standing in front of an audience and talking about sex just felt so natural and easy. I was instantly like, oh, this, obviously.
I came to speak at the school you work at. Mm-hmm. Did you become a peer sex counselor or did you stay in the health peer health counselor?
So the way our peer program, and this is the case for a lot of big campuses, I went to University of Delaware for undergrad.
Okay.
Yeah. So big campus. And the peer health educators tended to be divided into subgroups. So there's nutrition educators and the stress educators and the sex educators.
You had nutrition educators?
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't go to the
There's
right
a
schools.
Really great peer education program at University of Delaware.
Okay.
Run by the very same woman who was running it when I was trained there, Nancy Nut Chase. Now she's married, Nancy Nut Chase.
Nut Chase.
Yeah.
I'm not going to even.
She's amazing. She does amazing work and she inspired me. I mean, I was a year or two into my degree and I thought, you know, psychology, cognitive science, I was going to be a clinical neuropsychologist and work with people with traumatic brain injury and stroke. Because I loved the research I was doing. I was doing research on children with Williams syndrome, which is this very rare genetic disorder that causes a really interesting cognitive profile. I love that.
You said really
research.
Interesting cognitive profile.
I'm not judging.
We're in a safe space here, Emily. Look, I'm not. It's because I'm a groupie. I'm an academic groupie.
Right.
You just need to accept that I think it's adorable. And also, I know what you mean by that passion. I just don't have the same work background and research background. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to shame you. I know you got that like, oh, I did it again.
Yeah. I sort of dip into nerd speak without realizing that I'm doing it. Like the most technical. I was in the session with Bear, whose last name I forget now. S. Bear.
Oh, I don't know.
We should look it up.
Okay.
But I was in the session. It was sex positive trans sex.
Mm-hmm.
And he was using deliberately hilarious terminology for genitals in order to keep it really gender neutral and really positive and not try to impose any sort of gendering on any genital parts. And so, like, entertainment center or Buck Rogers... Which is, Buck Rogers is my new favorite term for genitals, and it is absolutely all-purpose. Anybody's genitals can be Buck Rogers.
It really is. It's true.
Yeah. So I'm going to be using that when I go to the New England College Health Association and present to physicians and college health educators and nurses. I'm totally going to call genitals Buck Rogers.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. We need to focus, okay. Emily. Yeah. Focus.
But, okay, so I wanted to be a clinical neuropsychologist. That's what I was going to do, is study brain injury and stroke.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was fascinated by it, but it got to the point of applying to graduate schools. And what I realized that even though I love the intellectual academic stuff, doing the peer education and the sex education in particular made me like who I am as a person. And I couldn't say no to that.
Aww.
So I ended up in Indiana, where I, through dumb luck, stumbled into the Kinsey Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And had several years of amazing experience that I didn't deserve. And basically, I spend every day of my life now trying to earn the experiences that I lucked into when I was 22.
Aww. 22-year-old just lost in the Kinsey archives, learning about all the sex research.
Yeah.
Did you see all the movies they have down there?
I did, actually. So they have this offsite storage facility where they keep the reel-to-reel films.
Right, of the original Kinsey, of all the scientists filming each other having sex and whatnot.
I haven't seen those, no.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about.
No, they have a whole facility where they store reel-to-reel films. I haven't seen the... I don't know for sure that footage actually exists.
Okay, because it was in the movie.
Yeah, it was in the movie. It's also in the biography on which that is based.
Okay.
Which you should, if you haven't read it, you should read it.
I have not read it.
It's really good.
The biography.
It is mind-blowing.
Okay.
Kinsey is, both from a personal perspective and from a research methodology perspective, he is, like, on a totally different level. The man is connected to God, like the way Newton is connected to God.
Really?
Yeah. He saw the world in a different way.
Okay. All right. I've never heard that. Like, someone who has the fascination for his mind, that it was just that unique.
Yeah.
So what do you have to say about Sex Drive?
Oh, God.
No, okay. So this is...
things.
I mean, we can't cover everything. And I know maybe if I speak at another college near you, I'm sure I have more we can talk about. But I asked you earlier today, like, what are you excited about? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the medicalization of female sexuality. And that relates a lot to what has been on my mind, which is Sex Drive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, Emily, I'm busy and I don't work out as much as I should. It goes in spurts, just like ejaculation. Oh, I'm going to cut that out. It's so gross. My issue is that I've almost, my sex drive, a lot of the month is down near like asexual levels, mm-hmm. where I know that if I work for, well, I don't know if that's fair to say asexual, because if I work and get into an aroused state, I will find desire, but I'm not just walking around like, got a bone.
You lack spontaneous desire.
I lack spontaneous... Thank you for that language.
Sure.
I lack spontaneous desire. But I also get asked by couples who their sex desire is waning mm-hmm. in their relationships. But I know that I just generally am just a little drained. So when you said that about female sexual desire and the mm-hmm. medicalization, I was like, tell me more. Yeah. What should I do?
So let's start with the idea of spontaneous desire versus responsive desire versus context-sensitive desire.
Ooh, three.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So here's the deal. The cultural narrative around sexual desire is that it's something that just kind of comes spontaneously. Mm-hmm. Like you're walking down the street and you see a sexy person, or just having lunch and you think to yourself, ooh, I would like to get some sex. Sex is a good idea. And so you go and get some sex where you can. A spontaneous desire, right? Mm-hmm. And about, I'm going to get these percentages wrong, but it's something like 70% of men experience mm-hmm. their sexual desire that way, primarily. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but primarily. And about 15% of women experience that as their primary
really?
Desire style. Yeah. So there absolutely are women who experience it as their primary desire style. About 30% of women and 5 or 10% of men have responsive desire, where they almost never experience a spontaneous desire for sex, but they're mm-hmm. not low desire. They don't not desire sex or not like sex. They're not dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. They just need to be in a sexy context before the desire for sex emerges.
That makes sense. Like candlelight.
Yeah. You have to create a context.
Atmosphere.
Yeah. Or just feeling really trusting of your partner and feeling Ooh. Really affectionate, or feeling like you really like your body the way it is. Mm-hmm. So creating that context is what it takes for that 30%. And then everybody else, about 50% of women, have context-sensitive desire, where they sometimes experience their desire as spontaneous, like when you're mm-hmm. like hot, falling in love early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Your attachment motivation system is firing side by side with sexual motivation and making that fire burn hotter. Whereas later in a relationship, that fire isn't burning anymore, and so mm-hmm. it's not creating the continuous spontaneous mm-hmm. desire. You have to tap into it more intentionally.
So familiar.
Yeah. So, and the solution, so there's nothing wrong. It just means you need to create the right context.
Okay. Was there a third one?
It's context-sensitive desire. Was the one in the middle.
Context-sensitive, spontaneous.
Yeah. So the fact that you probably have, it sounds like you've experienced spontaneous desire in your life.
Yes.
And not lately?
No.
So you're in the 50% of women who experience context-sensitive desire.
Okay. Was there a third, wait, context, spontaneous.
And responsive.
Responsive.
Yeah.
Oh, I missed the definition for that.
So responsive are the women who more or less exclusively experience desire only in a context that is already quite erotic. So they don't experience spontaneous desire.
Oh, okay. So it has to be quite erotic, like
porn yeah. or
like, so instead watch. Of the like, ooh, I would like to go get some sex, like your partner starts kissing on you and you're like, well, that's nice. And then they start like kissing your neck and you're like, that's really nice. And then they start touching your boob and you're like, I would really like some sex. That's a good idea.
God, so many women have told me that that's what they need to get in the mood
yeah.
is another partner. But then we always talk about how we need to take control of our sexuality and yeah. masturbate. But then they don't find that they are ever in the mood. So mm-hmm. have we been inadvertently shaming people who have a different desire mode? Or
I think we have not been creating sufficient space for women whose desire style doesn't conform with the standard narrative. Mm-hmm. Giving women permission, just even giving women the language of responsive or context-sensitive desire, helps them to understand that they're not broken, they're not dysfunctional, there's nothing wrong with them, they just need a better reason to have sex than there's a sexy person right there or orgasms are fun.
Huh. And I love that you said that it was 70% to... and then because yeah. that of men, because
it's totally an androcentric model of sexual functioning. We assume that the way the majority of men function is the way people are supposed to function, that if a woman's body doesn't work the way a man's body works, it's somehow broken inherently.
Exactly. And that means 3 out of 10 men
yes.
aren't just wanting to bone spontaneously, yes. which is great to hear, because I get a lot of questions from guys who are like, yeah. I'm broken.
Yeah. And that 70%, or I don't actually remember off the top of my head what the number is, but it's more than half. They also, under adverse circumstances, can experience context-sensitive desire instead. If they're really stressed, 80% of people of all bodies, when mm-hmm. they're depressed or anxious, experience a decrease or some effect, negative effect on their interest in sex. So stress absolutely reduces interest in sex.
What else reduces?
Oh gosh, there's a really long list. Can I do a technical bit? So yeah. about the reason why the things I'm about to say affect sex drive?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so how the mechanism actually works in your brain, there is a...
Ooh, mechanisms in brains!
Yeah, mechanisms
in
the brain.
Strap in, everyone.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to tell you that it's called the dual control model, right? Okay. And I'm going to tell you that one of the parts... So how many parts are there in the dual control model?
Probably two.
There's two. And if one of them is the gas pedal, what's the other one?
The brakes.
There's a brake.
Are we talking parasympathetic nervous system, etc.?
No. It's analogous, but not identical. Yes.
I love it. Let's go.
Okay. So this is the dual control model. There's your sexual excitation system, which is the sexual accelerator.
Sexual excitation system.
Right. It notices all the sexually relevant information in the environment.
Like boobs.
For example, if that's sexually relevant to you, which it's not to everybody, but for some people it totally is.
Right.
And it sends a signal that says, turn on. And at the same time that that's happening, your sexual inhibition system, CIS, the brake, is noticing all the very good reasons not to be turned on right now. Mm-hmm. And it is sending a message that says, turn off.
Sexual inhibition system.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you just think about it as brakes and gas, mm-hmm. that'll get you everywhere you need to go.
Well, I want to make sure I remember Googleable terms because I want to look up stuff.
Dual control model is
okay.
what you Google. Eric Janssen and John Bancroft are the two guys who authored it.
Okay.
Back in 1999 is when the very first journal article was published about the dual control model.
Wow.
Yeah. And over the last 15 or so years, the research has been growing. It is the foundation of how I think and talk about sexual response.
Really?
It is, yes, central. If I could avoid talking about Masterson Johnson's four phases, I would. I don't think it's that useful or relevant anymore. Like, we need to move on. Mm-hmm. We're out of that. We're out of Kaplan's triphasic model, too. Mm-hmm. Desire, arousal, orgasm. That's like, that's over now.
So you're saying that the dual control model is a more relevant and inclusive mm-hmm. model of desire, past Masterson and Johnson, et cetera.
Right.
Okay.
And it explains why responsive and spontaneous desire are both normal.
Okay.
Right? Because everybody's different in their sensitivity of their brake and their gas. So if you have a really sensitive gas pedal and like no brakes, mm-hmm. what sort of sexual response do you have?
Super horny.
Right.
Which, spontaneous.
It could be. It's definitely spontaneous, and it could be lots of fun. And under the wrong circumstances, it can actually turn into sexual compulsivity and high-risk behavior.
Okay.
These are the people who are most likely to experience... So remember how I said 80% of people experience a decrease in their interest in sex when they're stressed or depressed or anxious? The other people are much more likely to be these high CES people or low CES, low CIS. So if you have a very sensitive accelerator or a very insensitive break, you're much more likely to be a person who, when you're stressed out, that increases your interest in sex.
CES versus CIS. Right. Excitement versus inhibition. Yeah. I see.
My editor would like me never to use those terms because they're so hard to distinguish and say breaks and gas forever.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, whereas if you have a very insensitive accelerator and quite a sensitive break, you have the opposite sexual response system, right? Most, and this is distributed on a normal bell curve, right? So most of us are heaped up in the middle. Most of us are just average. And a small proportion of us have very sensitive breaks or very sensitive gas pedal, and they don't co-vary. So you can have sensitive breaks and sensitive gas pedal at the same time.
Co-vary.
Yeah, so it means that just because you have high of one or the other doesn't mean you will have high of the other one. They vary independently.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So
it's not like astrology where you're like, oh, you're a low gas pedal. That means you have a high this pedal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's not, yeah. The two functioned quite separately, which is important.
Do you believe in astrology?
No.
Neither do I. Okay. Moving on.
I believe that people believe in it.
Right. This is, we need to not give any time to this.
Yeah, okay.
Getting back to the pedals.
So, okay. So there's a brake and there's a gas pedal and people vary in the sensitivity of it, right? So people who have more sensitive brakes and less sensitive gas pedals are more likely to have responsive desire, right?
Of course, because it's easier for them to get out of excitement.
Right, and less easy for them to get into excitement, both of those at the same time. And it only takes one or the other to create a more responsive desire style.
And responsive isn't just lighting some candles. That means like... is there any other type of way of getting in the mood besides... When I think of responsive, I think of a partner initiating. Yeah. But what is responsive outside of a partner being involved?
Lots and lots of things. Okay, so I define context as the combination of your external circumstances and your internal brain state.
Okay.
So external circumstances includes things like your relationship with your partner and the things your partner is doing, whether or not the door is locked, whether or not you worry about being interrupted, whether or not there's a real risk of that, right? Your external circumstances. And then there's your internal brain state, which is all the other motivational systems that are functioning simultaneously in your emotional one ring. I call it the one ring in your brain.
To rule so all you know your genitals.
There's all this media coverage about brain imaging of like porn and sugar and cocaine, and it's like, oh, the same brain parts light up when you both. There's only one emotional brain system. Of course the same parts light up. There's only one. Of course there's not a whole separate cocaine system from a sex system. There's pleasure and avoidance, and that's it.
I think of us as very amoeba about that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So yeah. So, but because they're all functioning in the same place, this emotional one ring in your mesolimbic cortex, they influence each other. So when you add, if you take sexual motivation as being activated, right, but stress is also activated at the same time, the stress affects the sex.
Okay.
And if you add love, attachment, trust, that affects the stress. So the stand, now this is not true for everybody. It's true for about 70% of women. The most sex positive context that creates desire is high trust, low stress, high affection, and explicitly erotic.
What is explicitly erotic?
Naked people, the sounds of people having sex, being sexually stimulated directly anywhere on your body.
Okay. All right.
Watching porn. Reading romance novels.
Okay. All right. There's a lot of romance novels in this world.
There surely are.
High affection? No. Yeah. What was the first one? High affection, low stress.
High affection, low stress, high trust.
Trust and high erotic.
Explicitly erotic.
Explicitly erotic.
Yeah.
Okay, this is exciting. I can't wait to listen to this back and take
everybody
notes.
Is different. They're in the book, which is not yet available, there are worksheets for thinking through. Like, if you think about a couple of times when you've had, like, amazing sex, mm-hmm. what was that context? What context created the amazingness that was that sex? And you can do the opposite of thinking through some not so great sex that you had. What was it about that that made it not so great? And figure out what the pattern is of context that really create intense desire and pleasure, and the context that hit the brakes.
Man. My issue, I don't even think of them as issues, but I'm starting to become more aware of my own sense of, or absence of feeling safe
mm-hmm.
for whatever reasons, and trust. Mm-hmm. Like, those have been coming up. Even I used to be more trusting and felt more safe than I do in recent years. I think that's really strange, but mm-hmm. I am becoming aware of that. So I bet that's affecting it too.
I bet it is. I would dare to say that even the exercise is a factor. This is a thing I talk about with stress a lot.
Oh, right, because we're talking about this, things that reduce it.
Because exercise is the single most efficient strategy for reducing your physiological stress. I talk about stress a lot. Do you want to talk about stress a little?
We can talk about it a little bit. I know that in my experience, I told a psychologist once psychiatrist who was going to give me antidepressants. Mm-hmm. I was like, look, doc, I know if I just exercise, I will feel better.
Yes.
And he sighed the greatest sigh because he was so glad that someone knew how much it would change my life.
Yes, it absolutely does.
And I still didn't exercise.
There's a reason why. Oh.
Okay.
In terms of the physiology of the stress response cycle.
Okay.
So, yeah, it is the stress response cycle, you'll mm-hmm. notice. So the evolution of the mechanism, here's how it worked, where it evolved, when our stressors had teeth and claws, right? Mm-hmm. So you notice a stressor uh-huh. out there in the environment, there it is, and it activates the stress response inside you, this adrenaline rush and the cortisol rush that increases your heart rate, it increases your respiration rate, it shuts off your digestion, it slows down your immune functioning, right? Your pupils dilate, all these physiological changes so that you can do what?
Fight and stuff, run and stuff.
If you see a lion coming, what do?
Cry, pee myself, lie down and die.
Fight or flight.
Fight or flight,
exactly. You fucking run.
Okay.
Can I say fucking?
Yeah, you can.
You fucking run. And there's only two possible outcomes here, right? When you're being chased by a lion. Mm-hmm. Either
you die
or
you get away.
Yeah. And if you die, then none of the rest of this matters.
Uh-huh.
And if you survive, if you run back to your village, we're in the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness now, you run back to your village and everyone in the village helps you to slaughter the lion and you eat the lion for dinner that night and then you bury the remains of the carcass that you're not going to use in an honoring ceremony after all of that. How do you feel?
Triumphant.
Yeah.
Safe. You're
glad to be alive. You love your friends and family, right?
Yeah.
That's the complete stress response cycle.
I see.
So when you're being chased by a lion, what do you do?
Run.
When you're feeling stressed out and overwhelmed by 21st century life, what do you do?
You should go jogging.
Any kind of physical activity communicates to your body that you're escaping from the stressor.
Oh my goodness. Does that make metaphor sense? Is not a metaphor.
Yeah, it's way more complicated than I just made it sound, but the thing is, physical activity is the single most efficient strategy to shift your body chemistry out of adrenaline, cortisol, stress response into endorphin happy land.
Oh my God, I never thought about that. You're not just like running like, oh, I guess. Okay, yeah, you just blew my mind. I'm pretty excited about it.
That's in chapter 4 of my book.
Awesome, which is called...
Come As You Are.
Come As You Are, out next year.
Yeah, not until March.
Okay, well, people keep downloading...
But that's like so important, right?
It's so important
to know
that.
And stress is such an important factor in everyone's stress response, but female-bodied people's sexual response in particular, that if they misunderstand how their stress is working, they're never really going to be able to access their full sexual potential.
Man.
And we didn't even talk about freeze, which is totally important. Should we talk about freeze?
I don't know what freeze is.
So, yeah, fight or flight, not actually fight or flight.
Fight or flight or freeze?
Yeah.
The three Fs.
Right, yeah. So there's flight happens when your body, in less than a second, sees the stressor and thinks, aha, this is a stressor I can survive best if I try to run away. And you feel fear and you run, right? Mm-hmm. If your body assesses the stressor as being, so like there's a person who's a little smaller than you coming up to the back of your best friend with a knife,
mm-hmm.
What do you do? What do you feel?
Fight.
Yeah. So your body assesses the stressor in less than a second as being something you can survive best by fighting. You feel what emotion?
Anger.
Anger. Yeah. All the different forms of anger, from irritation that you feel when you're in slow traffic, mm-hmm. up to full-blown rage, right?
It's exciting.
And you beat the shit out of the person.
Yeah.
And then you feel better. It's the same cycle, mm-hmm. just a different assessment of the stressor. Freeze is different. Those are both, you mentioned sympathetic, parasympathetic. Those yes. are both sympathetic stress responses. Then there's the parasympathetic stress response, which is freeze. When you're experiencing a threat that your brain assesses as, okay, I can't survive this by running. I cannot survive this. And I'm going to put a trigger warning right here.
Okay.
Feel free to fast forward through the next 30 seconds. When your body notices a stressor that it's like, okay, I can't run from this and I'm too weak to fight. What am I going to do? It hits the brakes and you shut down. Right.
Like when you're being raped.
Right. So sexual assault is the most common way that people experience this. Mm-hmm. But it actually happens in a lot of other contexts. I have mm-hmm. a friend whose son needed emergency surgery on his finger. And he sat mm-hmm. for 5 hours, stressed out and anxious and behaving himself in the emergency room before he had his surgery. He went under anesthesia. And when he came out from under anesthesia, mm-hmm. anesthesia is medically induced freeze. Mm-hmm. When he came out from under anesthesia, he was cycling his legs and saying, "Mommy, I want to run. I want to run. I hate you, Mommy. I hate you." And like hitting his mom, who just laid beside him in the bed and held him gently and was like, "You're safe. You're all right. You're safe." It took about an hour for his body to get through to the end of the stress response cycle. Mm-hmm. But he got out. That's the thing, is when you slam on the brakes that way, you're interrupting the stress response cycle, mm-hmm. and you need to take off the brake and allow that process to complete. Does that make sense?
It does.
And you see it in the wild all the time. Like if you're an antelope being chased by a lion and you feel the lion's teeth clamp into your butt, what do? You collapse to the ground.
Oh, like a little possum.
Yeah, like exactly, right? And the lion goes away to get her cubs, believing that she has been successful in killing you. And you, here's the most important thing. What does that antelope do before it gets to its feet?
I don't know. Shake it off?
Yeah, it shakes. It sits there and it vibrates and twitches.
Ah.
And what's happening is the motor patterns that were activated in the antelope's brain in the fight or flight response are completing those patterns. Those cycles are finishing. When it gets up, it shakes itself off, it heaves a great big sigh, and trots away.
So shaking your body and kind of just sort of flopping around for a minute actually does help you move through your stress.
You can feel your body wanting it. When you pay attention, you notice your body's like, and when you're not safe, trauma survivors in particular will be like, I cannot come out from freeze, because the reason you go into freeze is because you have a life threat stressor.
Yeah.
And coming out from freeze means that you have to face the life threat stressor. So this is what therapy is for learning that you are now safe, creating an environment where you can safely unlock the brake.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What? Okay. Oh, because I have been going through therapy for about 2 years, and it has been such a... It's been amazing. It's been such a wonderful tool. It really has. Now, when I asked you about talking about sex drive, you kind of went off for a minute.
Yeah,
and I wanted to bring it back to that because you said it was not a drive.
It's not a drive.
And because I think of it as like the natural, like our,
right.
the drive to eat and the drive to sleep, the drive.
Right.
But tell me about
that. So saying it's not a drive is not saying it's not natural. It is natural. Drives are this very specific biological mechanism of allostasis, or homeostasis is how most people think about it, where you have to return to a particular baseline. It's like a thermostat, where if the temperature in the room goes a little above or below where it's set, the heater kicks on, and then when it goes off, it clicks back off. So you feel hungry, you have this unpleasant internal experience of hunger, right? Mm-hmm. Which motivates you to go out into the world and get the food. Mm-hmm. You eat, and then you feel full and you stop, mm-hmm. right? That's a drive.
Okay.
Thirst is the same, mm-hmm. where you feel an uncomfortable internal experience. You consume some fluids, mm-hmm. you reduce that, and you stop drinking.
Yeah.
Right? Sex, there is no aversive internal experience that happens. There is no...
Really? I get kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah, there is a thing that happens. Okay. Yes, there totally is a thing that happens. What you're experiencing is an incentive motivation system, which is a terrible phrase. Sex drive is so much easier to say. And I do say sex drive just because it's so easy to say. But it's not just... It's not, because drives are about survival. Frank Beach in 1956 said, no organism has ever suffered tissue damage as a through lack of sex. Basically, nobody ever died because they couldn't get laid.
Okay.
Ever. Like, you don't die as a result of it. But you do experience a wanting, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a need, but it is absolutely a want, which brings us to what I call the little monitor. So there's this little critter in your brain.
Ew.
There isn't actually a little critter in your brain. This is a metaphorical critter. The technical term is discrepancy-reducing feedback loop, but who fucking cares about discrepancy-reducing feedback loop? It's Google-able. The little monitor in your mind. So Charles Carver is the researcher you want to look for if you're looking for research on the criterion velocity of the discrepancy-reducing feedback loop.
Okay.
Yeah, Google that.
Yeah.
Because, dude, it's so amazing. This research changed my life. Okay, so here's the deal. There's a little monitor. There isn't really a little monitor, but pretend
there's a little monitor okay.
who knows what your goal is, mm-hmm. knows how much effort you're investing toward the goal, and how much progress you're making toward the goal, right? Mm-hmm. And the little monitor also has a very strong opinion about how much effort it should take. Mm-hmm. So this is driving to the mall. It's supposed to take 20 minutes. It's taking 30 minutes. How does that feel?
Stressful.
Yeah, exactly. So the deal is it's called your criterion velocity, this opinion. And when you are functioning below or at the criterion velocity, so you're making really good progress towards your goal, that feels spectacular. Yeah. You feel accomplished and great. When you move above the criterion velocity, you start to get frustrated.
Uh-huh.
And eventually you become enraged, ooh. Right? And then the thing that happens, and this is totally crucial, is that when your brain switches from believing the goal is achievable to believing it's unachievable, the little monitor pushes you off an emotional cliff into the pit of despair.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
The pit of despair.
Yeah.
Is it real? Is the pit of despair real?
Yeah. The pit of despair is one of the primary sources of depression. You get trapped in the pit of despair.
Like, wait, isn't that in a novel, The Phantom Tollbooth? Oh, wait, The Doldrums. Never mind.
Yeah, The Doldrums. Pit of Despair is Princess Bride, actually. Princess Bride is where I first heard the term pit of despair. But the next place I heard it was reading Harry Harlow's research. Harry Harlow is nowadays quite a controversial researcher in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and into the early 80s. He did non-human primate research that I won't tell you about it because it really is extremely disturbing, where he induced pit of despair.
Whoa. Yeah. That is controversial.
Yeah. Yeah, things have changed since then.
So what can people do if they get into that place where they feel like it's impossible?
Here's the thing is it's not actually impossible. You are not trapped forever. If you think about the structure of the system, right, the frustration and all that, there's three different approaches that you can take to getting out of the pit of despair.
One
is to change the goal.
Okay.
Maybe this just was the wrong goal for you, so find a different goal. Hmm. If you've been in the pit of despair for a while, try a goal that is pretty small and achievable.
Kind of like mutual masturbation when, instead of having to get penetrative sex from your partner.
Or in sex therapy, they do a thing called sensate focus. Mm. You eliminate all genital touching and you just have one person touch the other for their pleasure and then you switch partners, right? And this takes away all the expectation. You change the goal entirely. You take away all the performance anxiety and all that stuff, right? So you change the goal to something much smaller stakes.
Totally.
So that's one. The second is to change the kind or quantity of effort that you're investing. So maybe you're just going in my office. I have this poster. It's a demotivator poster from despair.com. And it's a picture of this penguin waddling away from the camera. And it says limitations. Until you spread your wings, you'll have no idea how far you can walk. And I actually find this very motivating because what it says is that if you can't get there the way you expected to, you can still get there. Even if you have to walk the whole fucking way, right? Maybe the way you get there is just totally different from the way you thought you were going to get there.
Yeah.
Which is what I was thinking through Bear's sex positive trans sex. Like, when your body doesn't match the body you want to have, you find ways to work around it. And that creativity and that curiosity and experimentation can be a source of pleasure and joy instead of frustration, right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then the third potential place to, so you change the goal, you change the kind or quantity of effort, or you change your criterion velocity itself. Maybe this just is a really difficult goal and you need to set your criterion velocity really, really high. Like you're climbing Mount Everest and you don't think of like, it's just going to be really hard. You take one step at a time towards your goal and you let it be hard.
And because criterion velocity
is that opinion about how much effort it should take to achieve a goal. Orgasm.
Oh, perceived.
So for women who lack orgasm or struggle with orgasm, they think orgasm's supposed to take 20 minutes and it takes their body 40 minutes to get to orgasm, but they'll never find that out if they get frustrated and give up.
Right. Okay.
Right. So just adjust your criterion velocity up to being like, it's just going to take an hour of Hitachi magic wand or whatever.
And you're
whatever.
Excited when it's only 40 minutes.
Yeah. And you're like, woohoo, 40 minutes.
Adjust your expectations.
Totally. You shift what the expectation is. And it goes the other way too. When it comes to pain, shift your criterion velocity way the fuck down. Do not tolerate pain.
Okay.
Sex is not supposed to hurt. And if it hurts, you go to a doctor. And if the doctor's like, well, sex just hurts, they're fucking wrong. And you need to tell me who their name is so I can let them know. There's a great book called When Sex Hurts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a great one.
Yeah, which which addresses many, many different sources of sexual pain. But the only place where you adjust your criterion velocity down is with pain. Do not tolerate pain.
Definitely. Well, I've been struggling with that lately, realizing how much in my life I have tolerated discomfort in order to make other people feel safe.
Yes.
And I've realized that I've created a lifetime of experiences where I didn't feel safe and didn't feel like I could speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I didn't really have a voice, but it's because I thought that I would impinge on someone else's well-being. Isn't that awful?
As though their well-being is more important than yours.
Right, exactly, exactly. Like caretaking or some shit.
Yeah.
This has been marvelous.
Oh, good.
Really delightful. And I feel like I want to title this like Sex Drive and Stress because I feel like it's so important, especially for people who are, I think everyone's a bit stressed out, but
yeah,
so many listeners are like really smart and really nerdy. And there's a lot of stress and anxiety going on in that demographic. You know, we're just kind of, strung out a little bit.
And in the 21st century, we don't experience nice, straightforward stressors like being eaten by a lion, which has a clear beginning, middle, and end. We have these chronic stressors where it never fucking ends the stress, right? So you have to build in those opportunities to complete the stress response cycle.
Mm-hmm. Closing this out, I have something to say that I think is really important.
Okay.
Which is that a long time ago, in a lifetime far, far away, I was trying to figure out how to describe what it is I do to people. And I thought sex nerd Sandra. And I had never heard anyone called a sex nerd before.
There is a whole story to,
And I looked online, and only one person in the world called themselves a sex nerd that I could find. And it was you.
I got the label sex nerd during the 2004 election. I don't know if you remember the 2004 election, but oh my God. I'm politically progressive, surprise. So we were watching, I was in grad school at the time, and we watched all the presidential debates and all the vice presidential debates. Gwen Ifill asked the two vice presidential candidates to talk about HIV globally, not domestically, but globally. Or no, not globally, but domestically. Okay. HIV domestically.
In the U.S.
As an African-American woman, she was asking, and African-American, especially young African-American women, were at that point the highest risk group. So she was asking this very important question, and both candidates talked about HIV globally. They didn't. They talked about internationally and not in the United States. And I had a shit fit about this. And that my friend Andrew looked at me and he said, you know what you are, Emily? You're a sex nerd. You're a nerd, but about sex. You care too much about too many details, and you cannot shut up.
Oh.
So at that moment, I was like, Yeah. Yeah. Sex nerd. Totally.
It's so nice.
I think since 2004, though, the meaning of nerd has changed. I think it has become more mainstream and more less derogatory than it was in 2004.
Which is good.
Thankfully. I mean, the first time I was called... Well, not the first time I was called a nerd, but in relation to sex, it was me caring too much and oversharing, and it wasn't positive at all. And I did kind of have to think about that and what that meant to be socially ostracized because of the way I talked about sex. And sure, nerd is way, it's okay. Now it's like, okay. Now we can like look at things specifically and isolate out things like social awkwardness and pinpoint that development instead of being like all nerds are like super awkward all the time.
Oh.
What?
That. So, yeah, this is like an epiphany for me of what the label sex nerd actually does, like with the power it carries. It takes the idea that you're a person who gets too excited and talks too much and too explicitly about an idea, and you're just like, well, she's a nerd. Of course she does that. She's a nerd about sex. As opposed to just being socially incompetent.
Right.
Which, like, if you go in public and talk about sex the way we have been talking about sex, most places, people would stare at you.
Well, but for us to bring that passion fully into a different social context would make us socially awkward because we would make it really awkward.
People would be very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had the experience of, like, getting off on a thing and people, like, just start closing down. Oh. You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. And sometimes because they were totally open to it for the first 30 seconds and they realized there'd be another 5 minutes of it. Yeah. And they're like, oh.
Yeah, like that just went way.
Yeah, no sexual shame. Just shut up already. but it has felt good to find out that I'm not the only one.
No,
you
totally.
Know? And that's been an amazing way to.
And what is the relationship between a sex nerd and a sex geek is a question I have.
I have opinions. Do you have opinions?
I have thoughts, not opinions. What's your opinion?
Not that everyone agrees, but when I talk to people in non-sex nerd circumstances, like just nerdy stuff or like a comic convention or whatever, people talk about people who like something specific like sci-fi books as being a sci-fi geek or like, oh, I'm a total music geek. But I find that my nerd, the DAO of nerd is just across the board, no matter what topic that I want to get deep into it. I want to soak it up. I want to ask all the questions and I want to get way excited about it. And it turns people off. Like I am just really nerdy, even though I don't flag for nerd. And so it actually, well, for me, I realized that I wish I had flagged more for nerd because then I would have hung out with people that would have been a better fit for me socially. But I didn't flag for nerd. I was kind of like this tough loner girl who wrestled. You know, like it didn't really work out in high
That's
school.
That's pretty cool.
It was, and it was fun. It was really fun. But like, I didn't fit in with the girls who asked me to do Star Trek role play, and then they never asked me back. And then I was sad because I wanted to play Star Trek role play. Anyway, enough about my childhood hurts. How about you?
My childhood hurts?
Yeah.
No, I was always a nerd. I was always like, so from fourth to eighth grade, I had literally no friends. I was a social bottom feeder, total outcast. Not because I was nerdy, geeky, intellectual, but because I come from a fucked up family of origin, and kids can smell crazy from a mile away. And they were like, I'm staying away from the crazy, which is perfectly understandable. And then I sort of got my shit together and it got better. But I always hung out with, like, the Star Trek kids a little bit and the RPG kids and the, That's fine. So geek to me sounds like, like comic books and Star Trek, and nerd to me feels more serious, I think. I know, but
it sounds more debilitating. it's a disease. It's very serious. It's a level 3.
It sounds, I don't know. I have no idea what the relationship between nerd and geek is. And it sort of feels like a way to create a club so that you can have a group of people that you hang out with. And God knows, sex educators are the most fun people to drink with in the world. I've been to a lot of conferences. I've drank with sex educators and sex therapists and sex researchers and people who don't do sex. And the sex educators are the most fun to drink with.
Oh, good to know.
For sure. Yeah. when you go to a conference, hang out with the sex educators.
I don't know. I have done some pretty hardcore partying with sex therapists. I've been pretty impressed.
Yeah, I haven't been impressed with the therapist. I've spent less time with therapists, honestly. I mean, less time in a social context. I've been in therapy for 10 years. But in a social context, I've spent less time with therapists. Okay. So maybe that's, I just don't know. But my experience is that the educators are the ones who pretend to be a condom when they put their arms around you.
Okay. You win. You win. Hands down.
Looking at you, Amanda.
Emily, where can people find you out in the world?
So I'm on Twitter. Mm-hmm. E. Nagoski, which is impossible to spell.
We'll spell it for us.
E, N as in noodle, A, G as in giraffe, O, S as in salmon, K as in kite, I. My blog is thedirtynormal.
Okay.
.com.
The Dirty Normal.
And yeah, those are the two main. And I'm on Medium at the same E. Nagoski.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
See, you did the impossible. You spelled your name. Yeah.
A miracle worker.
You really are. It's amazing. All right, kids, as we say around here, go team fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Meep.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.